Good morning, everyone. Sorry for the confusion this morning. You know, school's out, so they're ripping up the building. There's nothing we can do. If you need source sheets, there are source sheets over here. Okay, so it's good to see everyone. I think this is my last time giving a class to this group. My wife and I and our family are heading back to Israel in August. I'll be in and out of Toronto, so I'll probably see people, but at least as a member of the Beit Midrash, this is my last time. Today, to finish off our series, I want to talk about this first Sephardic chief rabbi of the State of Israel, Rav Ben Zion Meir Chai Uziel. I gave you a picture here in the front. He was born in the 23rd of May, 1880. He died on September 4th, 1953. He was first the Sephardic chief rabbi of mandatory Palestine, so Palestine under the British mandate from 1939 to 1948. And then once the state came into existence in 1948, so he continued in his position as chief rabbi until he passed away in 1953. I gave you the biography on the right-hand side of his picture. He was born in Jerusalem. His father, Joseph Raphael, was the Av Beit Din. He was the head of the rabbinical court of the Sephardi community in Jerusalem, as well as president of the community council. At the age of 20, he became a yeshiva teacher and also founded a yeshiva called Machzikei Torah for Sephardi young men. And then I gave you in the first source, just to get his biography a little bit, this is just from Wikipedia. The very authoritative source. In 1911, Uziel was appointed Chacham Bashi of Jaffa in the district. Chacham Bashi is the traditional term for the Sephardic chief rabbi. Traditional is in going back several hundred years before the state. There he worked closely with Abram Eisenkook, who was the spiritual leader of the Ashkenazi community. Immediately upon his arrival in Jaffa, he began to work vigorously to raise the status of the Oriental congregations there. In spirit and ideas, he was close to Rev Cook, that should be, I don't know. Okay, no editor on Wikipedia. And their affinity helped to bring about more harmonious relations than previously existed between the two communities. During World War I, Uziel was active as a leader and a communal worker. His intercession with the Ottoman government on behalf of persecuted Jews finally led to his exile in Damascus, but he was permitted to return to Palestine, arriving in Jerusalem before the entry of the British army. In 1921, he was appointed chief rabbi of Salonika, accepting this office with the consent of the Jaffa Tel Aviv community for a period of 3 years. He returned to become chief rabbi of Tel Aviv in 1923, and in 1939 was appointed chief rabbi of Palestine. Uziel was a member of the Jewish Assembly of Representatives and the Jewish National Council, as well as being a representative at the meeting which founded the Jewish Agency. He appeared before the mandatory government as a representative of the Jewish community and on missions on its behalf, and impressed all with his dignity and bearing. He was also founder of the Yeshiva Sha'ar Tzion Yerushalayim. He contributed extensively to newspapers, periodicals, and religious, communal, and national topics, as well as Torah, Novella, and Jewish philosophy. So in general, he's a very accomplished... Yeah?
What does Bashi mean?
I have no idea. In Arabic, I don't know. It's Arabic. Yeah, Chacham Bashi, I believe, is Arabic. But Rav Uziel, so he has a storied rabbinic career. Mostly he's in... his career is in Israel, and of a sense of responsibility to world Jewry, he takes that three-year position in Salonika. What I want to do today is examine some of the ideals that Rav Uziel represented. So if we want to figure out, so we've got a little of his biography, but who is this person? Right? What defines him? I love Rav Uziel. He's really a fascinating personality. But what defines him? So sometimes when you're trying to figure out what defines someone, you have to guess, right? You look at their life, you see what they did, you see what they wrote, and you try to tease out their worldview. Rav Uziel makes it easy for us because Rav Uziel felt that he had a message for the world, and therefore, before he died, he wrote an ethical will. And in the ethical will, he summarized what he saw as his life mission and his life contribution. So first, I want to go backwards, right? I want to start at the end of his life. I want to see what did Rav Uziel think he accomplished in all those years as chief rabbi of Yafo Tel Aviv, chief rabbi of Salonika, chief rabbi of Mandan, Palestine, chief rabbi of the State of Israel, founder of the Jewish Agency, all those things in his own biography. What was he trying to do? What did he think he was leaving the world with? So if you look at number two, this is how Rav Uziel summarizes his own life. To spread Torah among students, to love the Torah and its mitzvot, to love the land of Israel and its holiness, to love absolutely every Jewish man and woman and the people of Israel in its entirety, to love God, the Lord of Israel, to bring peace amongst all Jews, physically and spiritually, in their words and actions, in their thoughts, and in the ruminations of their hearts, in all their steps and deeds at home and in the street, in the village and in the city, to bring true peace in the house of Israel to the entire congregation of Israel and all its subdivisions and groupings, and between Israel and their Father in heaven. These goals are actually one, since they stem from one source, namely the Torah of the living God and the King of the universe, who is the King of Israel and its Holy One, who gave the true Torah to his people, a Torah all of whose ways are pleasantness and all of whose paths are peace. And Rav Uziel tells you he had two missions which are one. Right? One was to bring peace amongst Jews, though we'll see later that it wasn't just Jews. Rav Uziel was committed to bringing about peace between the world, peace in the world. You know what? Let me see. Yeah, you know what? Just because this story is so good and I want to get you into who Rav Uziel was, let's jump. Okay, Rav Uziel tells you that his mission in life was to bring peace and love amongst Jews and to bring the Jews closer to their Father in heaven. Right? Those were his two goals. But the truth is that first goal of bringing peace, as I mentioned, for Rav Uziel wasn't just about bringing peace amongst Jews. He was committed to peace between everybody. Now, living through the tumultuous times that were the 30s and 40s, as the state was coming into being, and with whom did one have to make the greatest effort to have peace in Israel? Right? The Arabs, right? The tension that was created there as the state was being created was great. And as we know, there were constant battles before the state, obviously in the War of Independence in 1948. But Rav Uziel was committed to bringing peace between everybody. So I gave you an 8. If you skip to the second paragraph there, I'll tell you the story. How committed was Rav Uziel to peace? So, in 1921, a battle erupted between Jews and Arabs in the outskirts of Tel Aviv. Right? Already, this is right before the 30s, 20s, right? 1921. So what would you do? Right? There's a battle raging. You are a rabbi in Tel Aviv, and there's a battle raging between the Jews and the Arabs in Tel Aviv. What do you do? What?
Tell everyone that it's time for prayer.
So that's sort of what he does. That's not what I would have guessed, right? So you are a worthy heir to Rav Uziel's legacy. I would have either, if I was brave enough, I can't say what I would have done. I would have either joined the army, right? Joined the fight, or ran away, right? Those are my two options, right? Those are the two options. Rav Uziel decided not to do that. He learned that both sides were shooting at each other, so he went out to the battleground in his rabbinical garb. Right? He decided, great idea, right? Let me get dressed up. And if you ever seen, you can see a little bit in the picture that I gave you, right? That turban, but there's also robes that come with it, right? The traditional Sephardi rabbinic dress is a bit different than the boring Ashkenazi dress that we tend to have. It's not a suit and tie, right? I mean, if you saw pictures of Reb Avadia Yosef, you know, till the end of his life, with the robes and the turban and the sunglasses, right? It's a different look. So he goes. It's a very commanding. It's a very distinctive look. So he goes out dressed up in his full rabbinical regalia. And fearlessly he walked between the two camps. Right? So they're shooting and he just, right? He doesn't run away and he doesn't take a side. Right? He just walks in the middle. And the gunfire stopped, right? Presumably there's just shock. No one quite understands why this regal-looking figure is walking into the middle of the gunfire. Rav Uziel, who is fluent in Arabic, spoke to the Arabs with emotions. He turns to the Arabs and he says, he reminded them that Jews and Arabs are cousins, descendants of Abraham. We say to you that the land can bear all of us, can sustain all of us. Let us stop the battles among ourselves, for we are brothers. And the continuation of that story was that indeed they stopped. Both sides were so moved by this act of bravery, of Rav Uziel entering literally into the middle of the battlefield without weapons, without taking sides, and turning in a sign of goodwill to the Arabs in his fluent Arabic and offering peace, that both sides lay down their arms, and at least for that day, the battle ended. Right, Rav Uziel was someone who was committed, as he said, to peace. Right, in his ethical will, he says, it wasn't quite prayer, but it's pretty close, to peace among the Jewish people. But as you see in this story, he was willing to put his life on the line to bring peace in the world. And if you look, actually, at the beginning of this paragraph, this is from an article by Mark Angel. He notes that this was something that Rav Uziel, that drove Rav Uziel throughout his life. Rav Uziel, who spoke Arab fluently, felt it was vital for Jews to establish good relations with their Arab neighbors. He strenuously criticized those individuals who, in the name of Judaism, fomented anti-Arab attitudes. This was a perversion of Judaism. Quote, the Torah of Israel, all of whose paths are ways of peace, calls for the peace and love of its people and all who are created in the image of God. It was up to rabbis to decry negative attitudes towards the Arabs. In 1927, Rabbi Uziel visited Baghdad and spoke to the Jewish community there, inspiring them with his message from Tzion. In his speech, which he delivered both in Hebrew and Arabic, he called on the Jews of Baghdad to share in the religious Zionist ideals, to settle in Israel, to maintain the religious traditions in the land of Israel. The Arabic newspapers of Baghdad praised Rabbi Uziel's speech and lauded his call for peace and friendship between the two great nations, Jews and Arabs, both peoples being descendants of our forefather Abraham. Right, so it wasn't just in the midst of the battle in 1921, but when he visited Baghdad in 1927, even though Zionism was looked upon as rebellion, it was looked upon askance by the local Arab populations, and despite the fact that Rav Uziel was coming as a messenger of Zionism, encouraging the Jews of Baghdad to become active Zionists, still, his second message of peace, to reach out in friendship and peace despite sharp disagreements with the Arab world, resonated not just within the Jewish community, but beyond. And it was reported in the Arabic newspapers in Baghdad that this great man, Rabbi Uziel, Rav Ben Tzion Meir Chai Uziel, had come and had offered his hand in peace. If you skip to the last paragraph there, he says, Rav Uziel fully believed that peace and harmony were achievable if goodwill could prevail. He was faithful to this vision throughout his life, even though it was rejected by political and religious leadership on both sides. Right? And knowing the history of Israel, you know, right, that this call for peace has not been one that has been heard on either side of the divide. Despite the fact that the majority of people did not want peace or did not think it was possible, Rav Uziel continued for his whole life, committed to preaching the value of peace, of trying to get the Jews and Arabs to create a brotherly or cousinly or whatever you want to call it, bond based on shared ancestry, on shared humanity, on shared a shared reflection of the divine image. And this was the goal to which Rav Uziel devoted his life. So now that we hear these stories about Rav Uziel, we get a little bit more into his personality. So what did this look like? Right? Besides for these dramatic moments in the middle of the battlefield, or his rousing speeches in Baghdad in 1927. So what did this look like? So before we look at what it looks like exactly, we have to add one more point. Rav Uziel was committed to peace, but he was also committed, now this is a contradiction, but a second of his commitments to which he devoted his life was recognizing the gift of the state of Israel. Right? Rav Uziel was the first chief rabbi, as I said, of the state, and he was there during the transition from the mandate to the independent state of Israel in 48. And Rav Uziel saw that moment as a paradigm shift, right? As something which had to be recognized, as something that had to be reckoned with. So if you look in 3, this is still from his ethical will, where Uziel writes, "A great and awesome merit has been revealed to this generation of ours, the revelation of God's mighty and hidden hand over His chosen people of Israel. He has gathered our scattered ones and has brought us back to our land, the inheritance of our ancestors, that we are here on the land, a nation dwelling on its own land. The ingathering of exiles, which took place over the last decades, is the seed of the flowering of our redemption. God spread a spirit of wisdom and heroism in the hearts of all our heroic pioneers." Right, he saw the moment of the creation of the state of Israel as a divine act, the beginning of a messianic period. And he looked around and he saw the ingathering of the exiles, the Olim that were coming from around the world, as evidence of the fact that Israel was entering a new era, one predicted by the prophets. And for Rav Uziel, those two ideals explain much of what he practically committed his life to. On the one hand, his love for people in general, and specifically for Jews, and his commitment to making everybody get along. And two, his belief that the state of Israel uniquely provided an opportunity to create a new culture predicated on those values. Right, Rav Uziel, he didn't just see the state of Israel as a incremental change in the way Jews experienced life, but as a radical shift that had to be contended with. And as part of that, one of the fundamental things he saw that was different was that he viewed the Aliyot, he viewed the people coming to Israel, not just as people coming to Israel, but as God's act of gathering in the exiles. And therefore, when Rav Uziel says he's committed to peace amongst Jews, and as chief rabbi, he's committed to implementing this vision in Israel, it's not just Jews. Right? He sees himself as the architect of the practical ingathering of the exiles. Right? How will we take not just Jews who happen to be here, but Jews who as part of a prophetic vision are coming back to their homeland, but with diverse cultures, with varying traditions. How are we going to actually make peace between such people? Right? How are we going to manifest his two visions, the state of Israel and a unified Jewish people within it? Right? What is that going to look like? And answering that question was one of Rav Uziel's life goals. So what is the vision? Right? What is the vision? You have all these Jews coming in. You have thousands, hundreds of thousands, eventually millions of Jews coming to Israel from Eastern Europe, from Western Europe, from North America, from South America, from all the Arab lands, from Australia, from South Africa, from wherever, right? Jews coming with all their traditions. And you want to create peace. And you want to create a joint culture. So what do you do? What does it look like? So let me pose the question this way, right? When I was thinking about how to pose it, and right, Tarchina and I were talking about it, we decided the best way to pose this is the American-Canadian traditional divide. When you bring in immigrants to a country, what is your ideal country? the melting pot or the mosaic? Right? Traditionally, right, America is the great melting pot and Canada is the great mosaic. Right? America believes that the ideal way to become American is to come, shed your individual identities, and become American. Right? Whatever that means. Whatever that means. Or if you're a New Yorker, to become a New Yorker. Okay. We have our own vision of the world. Anyways, Canada celebrates the mosaic. The greatness of Canada is that people come and become Canadian without shedding their identities. And Canada, there isn't a Canadian identity. A Canadian identity means you maintain your identity and still feel Canadian. Now, there's been, you know, all types of disputes as to whether the melting pot is better, the mosaic is better, and at this point, multiculturalism has led many in America to question the melting pot model, and we can get into these arguments from today till tomorrow. You go on Wikipedia under melting pot and you'll see that, and I really don't know what any of this means, but sociologists have had disputes. Should we be a mosaic or should we be a melting pot? But then they say, no, that doesn't capture it. So some sociologists suggest that we should be a salad bowl because a salad bowl is fundamentally different than, I don't know what that means either, but okay. And then there is one that I am partial to, despite the fact that all these sound strange, right? But there is a sociologist who suggested that the ideal model is what he calls the kaleidoscope because the kaleidoscope is constantly changing, right? It's a very nice model, isn't it? Right, that the kaleidoscope is constantly changing. Right, that at different points, different models work, and each way you mix and match it creates a different vision. Right, so that I actually am partial to that, but we'll come to that in a minute. But let's start with that beginning: the mosaic versus the melting pot. So that's America and Canada, but now let's move it. Israel. What do you want Israel to be? You are the pioneer. Right, you're a pioneer. You are the architect. You are the chief rabbi. 1948. You are watching these ingathering of the exiles. They bring their traditions with them. And you want peace. But there's two types of peace. There's the melting pot peace, where we have peace because we all become the same. And there's the mosaic peace, where we learn to live with varying traditions. Which do you want? Yeah?
Common language.
So let's push that farther. So what do you want?
Communication on mass communication to understand each other.
Right. So which does that fall under? Melting pot. Right. On the one hand, there are certain elements you really do want a melting pot. Right. There's a beauty to the melting pot. Right. Especially in Israel. Right. Language is a good example. Right. It's very nice to say, look, let's have a mosaic. Right, everyone bring your own language, right? On the other hand, then you have the Tower of Babel, right? No one can communicate. And if we believe that Hebrew isn't just a language, right, but it's our language, right? So encouraging the melting pot, that we should all speak Hebrew, isn't just a pragmatic argument, right? It's an ideological claim that we should melt into our historic identity. So on the one end, right, you might say, we want the melting pot. On the other hand, we all know, you go to Israel, and it's beautiful. The mosaic is beautiful. Right? You go around and you see. Right? You see, you walk down the streets of Yerushalayim, and you see whatever, right? You see evidence of, you know, you hear the languages, you see the Americans and Canadians who've made Aliyah and have their nice apartments in Rehavia and Katamon, and you have the French who have their summer houses in Katamon, and you have the Russians who came in en masse, right, and populate every part of the country, and then you have the Sabras, and then you have You know, then you hear Spanish, and you hear, you know, and you see shuls of everything, and you see on one street you have a kollel, on the next street you have a bar, right? You have everybody, right? You go to Tel Aviv, the culture is so different from Yerushalayim, and it's so different than it was 10 years ago, right? 10 years ago, Yerushalayim was the religious city, and Tel Aviv was the secular one, and now there's been a religious revival in Tel Aviv, so you have both, right? You have the cosmopolitan Tel Aviv, right? The secular Tel Aviv, and then you have the religious renewal. You have everything, right? And it's beautiful, and we're all there. So which do you want, right? Which do you prioritize? Which piece do you want? Yeah?
We need to have, though, the melting pot energy, because it's a small country. You need much more. You probably need a bit of both, but you need more of the melting pot, simply because it's a very small country with a lot of people who don't like us, and we need to be united in order to unite against those guys who don't like us.
Good. So it's funny, right? Normally, when I talk about Rav Uziel in Canada, at least, most people are on the side of Mosaic. But you're all on Rav Uziel's side, which is melting pot. But let's see how that happened. So here's what happened.
Salad.
What?
I like the salad.
You like the salad bowl. Good. The salad bowl. And I like the kaleidoscope. You know, whatever. We're all... But, So here's what happened. He gets a letter from Rabbi Levitsky. Right, Levitsky is the rabbi of Givat Ram and Givat Rambam in Tel Aviv. Right, Levitsky will eventually become well known when he becomes the he is the rabbi involved at the beginning of the of which we discussed 3 weeks ago in the Langer affair. Right, the Langer affair, he is the rabbi that gets caught in this fray. So he becomes well known because, unfortunately, he got caught up in the politics. But he writes a letter, and this is what he says. He says, "Enlightened Rabbi, right, Rav Uziel, the question that came to you, as thank God in our days, the settlement in our holy land has increased, may it continue to increase. Many of our brothers have gathered here from all scattered parts of the exile with unique customs and prayer and the like. Each as he received from his parents, that he has been accustomed to his whole life, and each loves his father's customs and won't move from them." Right? Levitsky looks around his shul in Tel Aviv, and he says, "Look, I have everybody. Right? Friday night, everybody comes. You hear all types of tunes, some with an Oriental twist, some with an Italian twist, some with a..." Right, with an Ashkenazi twist, right? You hear everything, and everyone, you know, has their own, says their own thing, right? Some people say Shir HaShirim before davening, right? The Song of Songs, some people don't. Everybody. And it's beautiful. And then he says on Sukkot, it's amazing. Because on Sukkot, it's a bit more dangerous, physically. Right? Because on Sukkot, everyone comes in with their lulav and their esrog. But there's a problem. Because different traditions shake in different directions. So if everybody shakes in the same direction, you're fine. Everyone turns this way, right? And you shake away from people. But if you have, right, multiple traditions, you shake, or you don't realize the person next to you is doing, right, and you hit them with the lulav, right? So this is, right, this is what he says, right? On Sukkot I saw regarding the shaking lulav, there were many different customs with many divergences. But despite all that, despite being whacked on the head with someone else's lulav, right, they all pray together in one synagogue, and each follows his custom, and good comes from it as peace reigns. The same is true for differences, for prayers and liturgy, tachanun, and as much as possible, each keeps his own customs. This is a daily occurrence with no breach. There's peace and tranquility. However, I am afraid that there may be a violation of making factions. So this is the question Levitsky asks. He says, there is a halachic problem called lo tidgo dedu, do not make factions, which the Talmud defines as don't have multiple groups practicing in different ways in the same place. So Rav Levitsky is torn. He turns to Rav Uziel and says, let's rephrase it. My intuition is that the ideal Israeli society is the mosaic, as long as there's peace. I look around my shul and that's what I see, a peaceful mosaic. But I'm concerned because I know that there is this prohibition which is hard to define against making factions. So he turns to Ruziel and says, is what I'm doing okay? Is allowing people to maintain their traditions okay? I expect that Rabbi Levitsky thought he would get one of two responses from Ruziel. The first possible response was, you're right, that's beautiful, and the potential halachic problems are not problems, and here's why. Possibility two, you're right, it's beautiful that everybody gets along with your varying traditions, but you're also right that there are halachic issues we have to deal with, here's how you can fix it. But he probably believed, and you can hear that in his language, that the one thing he thought Ruziel would agree with him on is that a peaceful mosaic is a beautiful picture. What he probably did not expect was what happened, which was Ruziel bashed him over the head, right, and said, no, you think the mosaic is beautiful? The mosaic is not beautiful. The melting pot is beautiful. The mosaic is a disaster. Why? So let's see what he says. Let's see why Ruziel didn't like this. Before we see him, let me add one point. As I mentioned, Ray Levitsky's concern is that there's a prohibition against making factions. Why is there a prohibition against making factions, however you've defined a faction? So this is a dispute. Maimonides says the reason we don't like factions is because we don't want people to fight. And people tend to fight when they do different things. I'm right. No, you're. No, I'm right. No, I'm right. No, I'm right. Right? We don't want that. Rashi, the classic commentary on everything, and everything, right, says no. The problem is what he calls Shoyiret Torah Kishke Torot. You don't want the Torah to look as if there are two of them. Now, what's the difference? If you think the reason we don't like multiple groups is because, right, and multiple divergent practices in one place is because we don't want people to fight. So what would happen if you could create a mosaic with peace? You'd say, great, right? I didn't want people to have different practices because I don't want them fighting. But if they can do different things and still get along, it's a miracle. Right? It's a miracle. It is evidence that Israel is the harbinger of the Messiah, right? They're getting along even though they don't agree. It's amazing. But what if you think, and we've already had several people raise this possibility, that the reason we don't want different practices is not because of fighting, but because there's a beauty to a shared tradition. So then, what do you want? Do you want the mosaic with no fighting? Not really. What you want is the melting pot. You want to forge a shared identity. Or let me put it slightly differently. You're at your Seder, okay? You're at your Seder with your brother, your sister, I don't know. And you decide, you sit down to your Seder and you say, you know, I remember those Seders we had growing up. I love those Seders. Let's make our Seder exactly like Mom and Dad did. It all goes great for Kiddush, right? And then, you know, you wash your hands, it's fine. Then you get to Karpas. And one of you pulls out the potatoes, and one of you pulls out the parsley, right? So suddenly you start fighting. Okay? Hold that scene. Second scene. You get together with your next door neighbor and say, let's make a Seder together. And again, you say, you know, we both had great Seders with our parents when we grew up. So let's bring the best of our parents' traditions to our Seder. So you say Kiddush the same way, and then you get to Karpas, and one of you pulls out the potato, and one of you pulls out the parsley. In case one, what happens? You fight. In case two, you have parsley and potato. Why? What's the difference? Because the second group don't claim to share a history. Right? They're each bringing their own tradition. So when one brings the parsley and one brings the potato, they're not a threat. But what happens in the first group? Why are the brother and sister fighting? Because they're both trying to recreate their parents' Seder. And they're arguing about what it looked like. But that indicates something important. Sometimes fighting is proof that we share a heritage. Because when we stop fighting, what we're doing is we're admitting that we don't share a heritage. Right? When we are okay with doing things differently, what we're saying is, despite the fact that you're Jewish and I'm Jewish, I'm an Ashkenazi Jew and you're a Sephardi Jew, and therefore it doesn't matter whether you do it differently than me, because we're two different types of Jews. So it might be nice that we're not fighting, but it's also a de facto recognition that we're really two types of Jews. But instead we fight and say, let's do this together, and then we scream at each other for 10 hours in the Knesset, right? How should we do it? Or in Shul, how should we do it? We may be fighting and screaming and yelling, but in that fighting there's a beautiful, subtle message, right? Which is, we believe that we share a heritage and therefore should be doing the same thing. So it's very subtle. Right? The Rambam says, I only don't want people to have different practices. Maimonides says, I don't want people to fight. But I'm okay, theoretically, with people doing different things. Rashi says, no, I don't want divergent practice, not because of fighting. In fact, there's a beauty to fighting. Because it proves that you are in it together. When you stop fighting, you stop talking, or not talking. When you don't fight and you go separate ways, it's because you believe that over history, what started as a single nation has splintered. Now, the truth is somewhere in the middle, right? The truth is that there's room for some things which are shared and some things which are unique. But which do you prioritize? So Rabbi Levitsky says, look, all I want is peace. And if different Jews can get together and not fight, if I could, that would be ideal. But Rav Uziel says, but you're missing something. And I think, coming back to what we said before, he has two things driving him. One is peace. But two, it's not just peace. It's a belief that the land of Israel, the state of Israel, represents a new type of peace, a new opportunity, the ingathering of the exiles. But what's the point of the ingathering if not, at some level, to forge a shared identity? Right? To just create a random mosaic would be to miss the opportunity of creating a joint state. Sure, we can bring the best of each culture. And certain things, you know what? You like spicy food and you like bland food because you came from, you know, Egypt and you came from Poland. Okay, fine, nobody cares. But you're not going to learn Hebrew. Right? You're not going to learn Hebrew. And I didn't give you... Did I actually? No, I didn't actually give this to you. But I'll say it outside. Rav Uziel is a different tshuva, since we've already mentioned this one. He was asked, dialect. How should you pronounce words? So Rav Kook said, everyone pronounce it the way you grew up. If you're Ashkenazi, then have your soft suffs. And, you know, keep it like a good Ashkenazi. If you are Yemenite, and you have your ayins and your hets and your, I can't pronounce the resh and the gimel, right? And you have your Moroccan, you have your jimels, right? So keep it. And whatever you do, even if you want to speak conversationally in Svaradit, in Ivrit, in modern Hebrew, when you get to shul, maintain your heritage. Rav Uziel said, that's a disaster. That's a disaster. You want people to be one way in shul and one way in the street? This is Israel. For whatever historical reasons, we've come up with the dialect of Hebrew that we did. Right? Some whatever, right? We've accepted, you know, Tufts, but we've rejected, right, from the Sephardi pronunciation, but we've rejected the distinction between different vowelizations. Fine. The Patach and the Kamatz have become the same thing. Fine. For whatever reason we did that, we did it. You're going to tell kids in school to be one way in shul and one way in the street? No! Our identity overflows from the shul to the street, from the street to the shul. Everyone should speak and daven the way they speak. Right? Don't make distinctions. So if you come back to this tshuva, you come back to this piece by Ruziel, this is what he says, and he gives you a theology for it. And he says, look, among all the virtues that distinguish and separate Israel from all the nations, first and foremost is the wonderful union of this nation and its Torah, which is the foundation of its nationality and the secret of its eternal existence. Right? We were all there together at Sinai. Thousands of years have passed since the revelation of Mount Sinai, and the Jews have been exiled many times, and from nation to nation, from kingdom to kingdom, with many decrees deposed on it, and its teachings to destroy or falsify it, to confuse its letters, disrupt its intentions. Right? We've been through it all. We've been through everything. Nevertheless, despite all of this, Judaism came out pure and complete in its character and spirit, united and unified in its foundation. And all those who tried to harm the unity of the Torah, the Samaritans, the Sadducees, the Essenes, the Karaites, and the sects of the disciples of false messiahs were completely lost or exist in a pathetic existence which will disappear from the world. This unity emanates from a faithful source of the Torah and of the living God, who is the only one in the world, unique in the heavens and the earth and all their legions, and therefore he commands his faithful prophet to his house to say, just as he is one in the world, so shall your work be special before him. Rav Uziel says, We've been in this together. We have a national story. And our national story started not just with peace, but with a shared tradition. God himself gave us a tradition. And therefore, our fulfillment of it reflects God's oneness. And then he says this association, which Israel is named, attests to the unity of the Lord. And when we are together and we're unified, that is evidence of God's oneness. Or the fact that we share a tradition is evidence that there was a single God who gave us a single tradition together at Sinai. A protector, a savior. And it is the union of God and the land that teaches man both in her Torah and her unity, the symbol of complete unity that has nothing to separate and disintegrate. And as we are commanded to be one association, we are also warned of a severe and threatening warning. You shall not make yourself into factions. And he says, that's why we don't want factions. Not just because it causes discord. Because you're the brother and sister making your say there. We need you to attest to the fact that you have a shared history. You have a shared upbringing. And when you create factions and don't care that Ashkenazim do this, and Sephardim do that, and Yemenites do this, and Polish Jews do that, and Galicianers do this, and Hungarians do that, and South Africans do this. What are you saying? Are you saying that exile has won? Are you saying that we went from being one nation to a shattered group, a splintered group? At some level, yes. At some level, it's true. We've each taken different traditions. But Ruziel says, this is 1948. You want to celebrate the fact that we've been in exile? That we've grown up separate for 2,000 years? Don't you want to forge an identity that reminds ourselves, that we once lived here together? That we once lived as one? And therefore, he says, we've learned from this that it is not permitted to make factions, except to engage with Ashkenazi and Sephardi communities, which are separate in their customs, and distinguished as special divisions. He says, look, I'm not realistically trying to get rid of every distinction. I can't deny history. Or I can't deny that you actually have lived in different places for 2,000 years. And I'm not trying to eliminate every difference. But he says, in any case, the law turns out to be very well, that all the customs of prayer, performance of mitzvot, and halachic rulings that are publicly performed in one synagogue, they are in general guided by the prohibition against factions. He said, I'm not trying to get rid of Ashkenazi shuls and Sephardi shuls. I'm not trying to get rid of everything. But I do want you to recognize the value of the melting pot. And if you're in one shul, so come up with a shared tradition and make that what you do. And it is very close to saying that it's a mitzvah that brings about a sin. And is it clear this is not a mitzvah, the finest garment? If you don't, you think it's beautiful? It's not. It's a sin. Because in the same shul to have all those traditions and not even attempt to forge a new identity, you're missing the point. We're commanded to maintain and emphasize in all our situations and work for the rock of our salvation to create unity with Israel and Torah. And how great and profound are the words of the sages that it is in the tefillin of the Holy One. Or the Talmud says that God, like us, wears tefillin. And what does it say in his tefillin? In our tefillin it says, Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. Listen, God is one. And what does it say in God's tefillin, so to speak? And who are like your people Israel, one nation in the land? That God praises Israel, you have made me a unit, right? A single unit in this world, and Israel is one nation in the land, right? The vision of the rabbis is that God celebrates the fact that we are a unified people. And therefore, if Uziel says, look, I'm not trying to get rid of every distinction, and I'm not saying there isn't a beauty in the mosaic, but we have an opportunity for a different type of peace. Right, we have the opportunity of the brother and sister who say, you know what? It wasn't a potato and it wasn't parsley, it was celery. Right? It was celery. Right? We have the opportunity to declare that despite the thousands of years and all the differences that have accrued and everything that's built up at our core, we started as one. And therefore, Uziel says, and he says this in a different tshuva, he says, I'm not trying to get rid of every distinction. But here's what guides me. Whenever possible, I urge people to forge a joint practice. Not always. I'm not saying there isn't a beauty to a mosaic. I'm not saying it's impossible for different traditions to exist. But when I have the choice to minimize differences and forge a shared identity, or to exacerbate, right, to accentuate division, I minimize it. Now, as we've said, there is a beauty to the mosaic. But Rav Uziel's unique contribution was to remind people there's also a beauty to the melting pot. It's not, you know, the problem in America, right, the reason people don't like it is because it's creating an identity. Right, you're forcing people to create an identity which from its beginning was just defined by whoever came. Right, being American, right, it didn't have, right, it started as a country of immigrants. It was always a country of immigrants. So people say it's just not true. What is this American that you speak of? To be American has been different in different times. But that critique doesn't work the same way for Israel. Rav Uziel says no. We're ingathering the exiles. What does that mean? We're ingathering the exiles. That means we're not a country of immigrants. We're a country of returnees. We're going back to a shared identity. And the fact that we're forging a new identity is a throwback to an era before we were scattered to the ends of the earth. And therefore, as I mentioned, the piece I didn't put here, right, he said, I can't have you speaking one way in shul and one way in the street. We're coming together. Part of coming together is language. However you speak, speak always. Now, you might think he went too far sometimes. You might not. But it's a beautiful vision. And Rav Kook didn't like it. As I mentioned before, Rav Kook didn't like it. But Rav Kook said, look, I do agree with one thing. I think that's an ideal. I think that's an ideal. He says when in the end of days, when there is a unified legal body for all of Judaism, there's a Supreme Court, so to speak, so then they will be able to have the final word and say, this is how everyone should practice. You just can't force it. But he agrees that there is a certain level of beauty to the melting pot. It is a testament to the fact that we started and therefore should end the same. And therefore, Uziel, who was committed to, as we saw, two things: true peace amongst the Jewish people, and two, recognizing in practice the unique moment that faced the Jewish people with the giving, with the declaration of the State of Israel, said it's time to not just recognize the beauty of the mosaic, of the peace of with multiple traditions, but to push at least as much as we can towards some melting pot. And we know that Israel prides itself on this. Right? Israel prides itself on the fact that people come and become Israeli. Right? I mean, right? When you make Aliyah, right? What they say, what they wish you, it's klita tova, right? A good absorption. Right? That's what we wish you. We want you to be absorbed into the fabric of Israeli society. That doesn't mean that Israel won't change with you, but we don't want you to remain in your little enclaves. Right, your little Anglo enclave and wherever, right? We want you to be part of the broader culture. We want to create an Israeli culture, a Jewish culture. And Rav Uziel was the spokesman for that type of unity. Right? Again, it doesn't mean there isn't other types. It doesn't mean that sometimes he didn't go too far. But there is a beauty in his vision. I'll take a question in just 1 second. But this commitment expressed itself in other ways. I won't read this inside, but in number 5, Ruzio was faced with the following. In Iraq, there were wealthy Jews who said, look, there are a lot of Iraqi Jews who've made Aliyah, who've moved to Israel, but they're poor. So let's raise money, but only for Iraqi Jews. Right? Iraqi Jews in Jerusalem. Is that okay? And Rav Uziel turns back to them and he says, look at the second paragraph. He says, before we discuss their words in terms of halacha, I said, I know you're asking me from a legal perspective, but before we get there, we must see what motivated them to come to this agreement. They say that this is not a cry of injustice or perversion of justice towards the poor immigrants from Iraq, but rather their desire was to build a platform themselves and receive monthly support. They'll be divided by the communities. They just say, look, this is not discrimination. It's just realistic. We take care of our own. But we're not discriminating. We don't want other people to starve. It's just, you know, we need to take care of our own. But then he says, right, even if we assumed that the revenues from Iraq are larger than all the other Sephardic communities in the diaspora, he said, let's even assume that you raised more money and now you want to give it to your own. Would this not be stingy and theft of the poor? To leave poor people who came from other diaspora countries whose residents are poor and cannot support their settlement in the Holy Land? Is this the way of Torah, whose ways are all the ways of pleasantness and his pathways of peace? He said, what are you doing? Right? We're in Israel now. We're creating a joint society. You're raising money in Iraq only for Jews who moved from Iraq? Why? Because you don't care about other people who moved from other countries who are poorer? Are you out of your mind? He says, before we get to the question of whether this is permitted or forbidden, he said, what drives you is your recognition that you're a different type of Jew. And therefore, it's justified to support your own. What do you mean, your own? Are the other Jews not your own? Right? Rav Uziel, this was where drove Rav Uziel. Where he said there's a danger to the mosaic. It's not just that it's nice sometimes. There's also a real danger. Because if you maintain the mosaic, you also continue to believe That we're not all in this together. You take care of your own, and your own is your own, is the Jews that came from the same place you did and share the same foods and speak the same language and have the same funny accent as you. Right? So the North Americans stick together. Right? Because we have our R's, right? Our races instead of our races or whatever. Right? We stick together. But he says, what is that? That's not what Israel, that's not why we founded a state together. We founded a state so you'd start looking at everybody as if they're your own. So this drove Rav Uziel. And that was what we've seen. That Rav Uziel, he was committed to peace in the world. Hence those dramatic stories with the Arabs. But his primary commitment in life was towards bringing a different type of peace amongst Jews. Not just one where we get along, but one where we start to believe that we really are one. And therefore, he tried to minimize varying practices. He tried to encourage people in their distribution of charity to distribute it from the perspective that everybody here is equally my responsibility, regardless of where we may have come from 5 years ago or 50 years ago. He encouraged everyone to speak the same dialect of Hebrew in and out of shul because he wanted to create a joint future, a joint identity. I'll throw out one last point. We don't have time to get into this. One of the things Rav Uziel is most known for currently in Israel was that he had a unique position regarding conversion. What became known as the Zera Yisrael position. What exactly it means is complicated, but what it clearly means is as follows. I didn't even give you the sources because it's too long. But Rav Uziel had this notion that if you have someone who's not halachically Jewish, for whatever reason, he's paternally Jewish, right? So from an Orthodox perspective, he's not Jewish. Should we encourage him to convert or not? Should we remove some of the obstacles towards conversion? And Rav Uziel argued yes, because he created a category that he called Zera Yisrael, that there are people who are part of this mission who aren't Jews, but do share, they are the seed of Israel. They are part of our broader picture. And for Rav Uziel, without getting into all the details, that position accords with his vision of life. Because I gave you in this, I won't read inside, but right, Benny Lau notes that whenever you find these tshuvot, these responsa by Rav Uziel, where he encourages taking, right, finding ways to convert people who are paternally Jewish, he constantly goes back to the verses in Isaiah and elsewhere that speak about the ingathering of the exiles. And Rav Lau notes that if you trace Rav Uziel, as we've already seen, Rav Uziel viewed his life through a prophetic lens. He saw Israel as the ingathering of the exiles. One expression of that for him was his unique commitment to the melting pot view of peace, of Jewish history, of finding ways to have a shared identity. But for Rav Uziel, part of the ingathering of the exiles is that who is part of the Jewish picture expands beyond those who are halachically Jewish. And therefore, whatever exactly Rav Uziel meant, which is not totally clear, right? He introduces this notion that our responsibility, right? You have these multiple levels. It's within the Jewish community. Then secondarily, part of ingathering the exiles is finding those people who are not halachically Jewish, but are part of our family law. More broadly speaking, and our job is to create peace with our cousins, with the Arabs in the area. Right? He was committed to peace at all its levels, right? In concentric circles, from the core of the Jewish community to those on the periphery to those beyond. And if you take his vision together, what you see in Rav Uziel is this masterful vision. Right, of someone who was committed, deeply committed to peace, but not just getting along. A peace that recognized a shared identity, right, a shared future, a shared tradition, right, who encouraged people to realize that we were at a unique moment in history. We have the opportunity to create a state together, to create an identity together, and therefore as much as we can, we should do that in the way we speak, in the way we act, in terms of those who we encourage to join our community. And we should reach a handout in friendship beyond our community, because that's part of recognizing who we are. We're not just limited to ourselves, but we recognize the humanity beyond our borders. And his vision resonated within the Jewish community, beyond the Jewish community. And, you know, Ruziel's legacy, as he left in his ethical will, is something that should inspire us to at least take some of that love and some of that zeal as we continue to forge our national story, to realize that we really are one. We are one family, and as a family we reach out beyond our borders, but it comes from that commitment to those shared ideals, those shared traditions, and a conviction that we all started together, and therefore we can all bring it to a close, historically, so to speak, together, and that will give us the confidence to bring peace beyond our family, but bring in all of those. And as it did, you know, we can pray that as it did in 1921, that his commitment spoke across and created peace, at least temporarily, between the Jews and the Arabs in that battle. If we're committed to having peace amongst ourselves and beyond, that vision will resonate, and his vision will be realized. So with that.